Okay. This is our class 26 in the Then and Now series. I can't believe we've had that many. It's half a year. And today's April the 15th. And today we're going to conclude the Bodhisattva vow material with your experience of this, and then go into the training in bodhicitta or awakening mind. So the what I left with you to do was to do the Bodhisattva vow on a daily basis over the last week. And how was that for you? So let's hear from you. Joe, do you want to start? Microphone's right there.
Only just tonight I realized I probably should have been actually doing the vow rather than just saying it.
Well, we're going to talk about doing the vow this evening, yes.
Okay. Well, because saying the whole vow, it's such a large piece that I had a hard time recognizing any physical response to it because I went to story so fast. I could make many stories about those stories, but when I broke it down into pieces, then I could find some specific reactions. I could find reactions to just about every piece of it. Because I was under a lot of stress this past week, some of my physical reactions were exaggerated. They all took the form of anxiety reactions, which I discovered a new one, which is sort of when I don't act out my anxiety, I sort of like exude it from my hands and feet and the backs of my upper arms. It's very interesting. But the emotion that went along with that was gave the name anxiety. And the one that I suppose is most created the strongest reaction was I confess all evil actions I have done. And the story around that, after those physical and emotional reactions, was confessing. And I know we talked about this some when we were going through the book.
Yeah, it's a translation problem. Maybe I should change that to I lay down or something like that.
In the sense of unburden?
Yeah, let them go.
Yeah.
I mean, we're influenced by Catholic sentiments. But the Catholic ritual of, or rite of confession is very much the same thing. It's an unburdening. It's like when you confess it to the priest, you're confessing it to God, and it's like, okay, I did this. And it's exactly the same process. It's and the purpose of it is to unburden. I was reading something the other day, and the word for sin apparently comes from the root to separate. So you confess the sins in order to lay them down so that you can move back into a connection with God. And it's very, very analogous to the process here. That help?
Yeah, it does. The laying down is clear. Of course, my understanding of the Catholic use of these is locked into such an immature, you know, young state. It never matured into the kind of understanding that we're bringing here.
I see.
It's very, very young and very deep. So, yeah, that is helpful.
Okay. What about the vow itself, just as the suggathas of former times aroused bodhicitta, aroused awakening mind? Because we have the stages. We have the taking of refuge, then you have the seven-section prayer, which is generating the right basis, going through all of those, and then you actually express the vow, and then there's the rejoicing, and then there's the dedication.
I am stopped. It seems like I failed to have a very direct experience of it because of the liturgical nature of it. I found it hard to translate it into a direct relationship.
Okay, we'll talk. I'll talk about that a bit more because that's important. Thank you. Okay, who else? Chuck.
Well, I used the Brown Book.
Yeah.
And the Basically, refuge.
It's the same thing. Yeah.
The refuge part. I had a feeling of, felt the feeling of trust and something to rely on, sort of a solid base. Mm-hmm. And the vow itself was more of a feeling of getting into action.
Okay.
Going out and really doing something about it.
So really directing energy in a certain way.
Right.
Okay. Anybody else? Randy, Julia, Chuck, and Yannick, Julia. Randy, go ahead.
Each piece brought up a different emotion,
mm-hmm.
and all very close to the surface. And I'm pleased to say I didn't act it out all week. and the curious, I like the vow, the phrase step by step, and it's used twice in there. I can cope with that. You know, I can't do this big leap of all beings and great awakening mind, but I can chunk along step by step, so I've resonated with that. And all week, I found myself in all kinds of different situations where when I'm starting to get into the storyline, a piece of this came up, different pieces. They all seemed appropriate for whatever was going on in my head at the time. It kind of pulled me out of the storyline.
So it cut the stories.
Almost as if, you know, somebody was saying it to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So okay. It was interesting.
Okay. Julia.
Yes, like Chuck, I did the Brown Book version. And I love the sense of belonging to a tradition that comes with that in both the vow and the rejoicing prayers.
Anything else?
Well, there's a lot of energy associated mm-hmm. with the vow.
Okay. Nana?
Also, it always brings... just a very strong sense of knowing what to do, kind of in opening. However, when I get to without delay, may I become a wonderful leader for sentient being, and all the from now on, I will do only what befits this family. I will do nothing to disgrace this noble and faultly family. All this, it just always bring, how can I mean, I know I don't do it. So I'm questioning, what is leadership for me? And what does it mean?
What is leadership?
Being a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it mean? Is it just a seed to begin something, or is it? It's a big commitment, so.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else want to say something before I talk about this a little bit?
I was just going to say that it brought up for me, I think I identified or had a good feeling from the rejoicing section and the refuge section. It just made me feel very grateful. I just felt really grateful.
Well, I'm going to start from Joe's comment here. In terms of context, I guess. I'm not quite sure what the right word is. Tibetan Buddhism, as it was practiced in Tibet, was a medieval institution. It was so utterly medieval. And the Catholic Church today is still a very medieval institution in many respects. One of the characteristics of a medieval institution is that there is a priesthood and everybody else is a child. And the function of the priesthood is to take care of the children. So I found your comment that the ritual of confession, you never developed a mature understanding of its actual spiritual purpose. And I think there are many people who grow up in the church for that is the case. And I know from talking with people that people who grow up in Buddhist countries relate to Buddhism the same way that many people in this country relate to their Catholic or Christian upbringing. It's like, you know, it's irrelevant, et cetera, et cetera. And there is... one of the classes I had, there was a woman who had grown up in that environment and then just said, you know, this is all nonsense, this doesn't mean anything, and then came into Buddhism as a Westerner. She'd come from Vietnam or something like that, so she came in from a different route. And it really meant and felt very, very differently. So that's one important thing to keep in mind about this. Second, this is a ritual. And one of the reasons I asked you to do this on a daily basis was to have you, for you to have the experience of doing something ritually. Now, when you do something ritually, your mind isn't always there, but you keep coming back and do it again and again, and gradually becomes part of you. And what Randy was saying is very much one of the effects of ritual. And that is that you do it again and again, it begins to soak in, and it just comes up, and it's just always available to you, and serving as a reminder or something for you throughout your day. That's if you keep it fresh. If it just becomes a empty ceremony for you, then it loses that. When I was doing my 3-year retreat training, we did this, we did many other rituals, and we would read lots of prayers every day. And it just made all of that teaching that was embedded in those prayers available to me. So I just have that. I don't have to go and look things up. It's just there. And then a lot of the Tibetan lamas, they memorized, as was part of their monastic training, they were large numbers of prayers, so they were just always available to them. That's one of the great advantages of that kind of rote training, which is completely out of fashion in the educational system today, but it actually has some really, really strong merit in terms of giving you a basis to train from. The third thing is that when you do this on a regular basis, you keep coming back to it, the vow sinks in. What several of you reported, that it gives energy, it gives direction. That's what ritual is meant to do. It's meant to focus your energies in such a way, lead you through an actual sequence of conceptual and emotional understandings. And so that you are familiarizing yourself. And that's one of the reasons why we do the prayers at the beginning and the end of our teaching sessions here, and why I took the time to explain, at least to some extent, those prayers a couple of weeks ago. From here, one of the things you can do is just incorporate this, if you wish, into your daily practice. When you've take the bodhisattva vow formally, then you're meant to renew it in some way very, very consistently so that it actually goes in. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is actually training in this. But and if you're mindful, you know, if you're actually reflecting on the meaning of the words, then everything is a constant reminder. As you were saying, you know, confessing on evil actions, it reminds us of, okay, well, maybe that wasn't such a good thing I did today. And then one of the other verses in the preparation is in the seventh section prayer is rejoicing in the good works of others. So that acts as a reminder. And reading these things over again and again remind us, keep these things fresh in our mind so that we're more present with those ideas, or those ideas are more present in us as we live our lives. I've also noticed Randy's comment about step by step. In the Zen tradition, they're much more absolute. You know, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. You know, it's like, okay, that's it. Reactive emotions are infinite. I vow to release them all. The ways into the Dharma are without limit. I vow to enter them all. You know, it's like, ah, what do you do? In the Tibetan tradition, there's far more emphasis on a progression, and again, I want to talk about that this evening, of initiating a process which then unfolds. And that is the purpose of doing this on a daily basis, is to plant the seed and to provide the ground and the conditions in which that seed is nurtured and grows in us. Because we've talked about karma earlier as a process of evolution. And the approach in the Mahayana as Gampopa is talking about it here, is very much seeing awakening as a process, as the result of a process of evolution. You'll find that in the Tibetan tradition, there is the what are usually translated as the causal vehicle and the result vehicle. Now, that term cause or causal is our old friend, which I just think should never be translated as cause because it's wrong. Just my little soapbox there. I would prefer to call it, and it may seem a little clumsier, the Genesis vehicle. In that we have this potential, and then which is the genesis of awakening. We've talked about this idea of genesis a lot, and we provide it with the right conditions, and it grows and manifests in our life more and more completely. And that's the process of waking up. That is why generating goodness, which you'll see translated in these texts as accumulating merit, but I prefer to think of it as generating goodness. And, nurturing pristine awareness, which they also call accumulating awareness. I'm not sure how you can accumulate awareness, but that's the old banking metaphor there. These are methods of fostering that process of evolution. So, please understand that it's a very good thing for you to incorporate this little ritual that I gave to you and put up on the website as part of your daily practice. Now, if you're really pressed for time, you can leave out the seven section prayer, but I think the seven section prayer is a good thing to do in its own right. And we went through the sequence of what each of the verses is referring to. Each of the verses actually counteracts one reactive emotion or one problematic way of approaching the world. So it's actually very carefully constructed. But the essence of the vow, which is just the Sagadas of form and times, aroused awakening mind and follow this training step by step. So too, for the benefit of beings, I arouse awakening mind and follow this training step by step. This touches on what Julia is saying. You are entering a tradition, a way of practice. Now, there's another little element that I want to touch on, which actually has only come to me relatively recently, so I can save you maybe 30 years here, which is always nice. Some of us are just very slow, that's all. One of the things I've always appreciated about Buddhism is its great emphasis on path, which is distinguishes it from a lot of the people who have spontaneous awakening, like Krishnamurti and Ramana Maharshi and all of these. I mean, they're very notable people in their own rights, but they downplay the role of path. And path is basically the process of the stuff evolving and growing in us and creating the conditions for that to happen. One of the things which the way that the Tibetan tradition is expressed and the way it is translated is there is very is that this is the path, and that I've always had a little bit of tension with that, because what is, you know, the stages of the path that you're meant to follow have never worked for me, so I've always had to find my own way. And then I realized that I actually do the same thing with every student I work with. I never work with two people exactly the same way. And then some comments that I was listening to from Stephen Batchelor pulled the whole thing together for me. There isn't the path. You find a path, and what you actually do is find your path. So it's a path to awakening for you. Now, it's very much working with that genesis of awakening, which we all have, and finding, discovering through a lot of trial and error and a lot of effort, how to provide that genesis of awakening with the conditions in which it can grow and find expression in our lives. And I don't think that any one person's path is identical with anybody else's. There are certain factors which really help and which have been tested by time and experience. And that's what Gampopa is relating here. You know, everything we've talked about in terms of impermanence and karma and the six realms and loving kindness and compassion, etc. All of these things, and what I talk about and Wake Up to Your Life, these are things which all help in this, but one has to find one's own relationship with them. And it is through that, through taking them in and finding one's own relationship, that you find the path for you. Through which you wake up, or this awakening manifests in your life. Is that clear, what I'm saying? Okay. So let's turn now to the next chapter. At long last. I don't know how long we spent on that last one. But it's a very substantial chapter. It actually could be regarded as the core of the whole book. This is in Gunther's, this is page 142. This is chapter 10, Training in an Enlightened Attitude, which is his translation for Awakening Mind. And in Kenshok Jiaotsen, it is chapter 10 again. It's on page 173. Calls it Training and Aspiration, Bodhicitta. Bodhicitta being the Sanskrit for Awakening Mind. Now, one of the things, there are a couple of things that I want to try to get across today. First, and these aren't in any particular order, I'm just numbering them because I just do that. One of the things I want to talk about is, again, it's a certain sense of how to read this text, how to understand this kind of text. But this is a little more specific in that in some of the stuff we're going to hit today, we find some principles which are applied to the cultivation of awakening mind or and training one in awakening mind. But these principles are actually applicable in many, many other areas of life, and I'm going to give at least two examples of that. So one of the things that when you read this and you come across this list, you know, and you go, oh, yet another list. Well, actually, these lists embody a tremendous amount of distilled experience and understanding, and they're well worth studying. And it's said of these lists, you not only have to know all of the items in the list, you also have to know the order, because there's another layer of or dimension of experience and understanding in the order of the list. The orders of these lists are usually not arbitrary at all. They've been thought out quite carefully. So that's one aspect that I want to touch on. The other thing that I want to set as a framework is that this is a system of training. Now, how many of you have trained in some kind of athletics or sports ever in your life? Okay, what do you do when you train? Chuck, you got a mic somewhere? Yeah.
You go out and work out on a regular basis.
Yeah, and do you do the same thing over and over again?
Yes.
A lot, right?
Right.
Okay, that's training. Why do you do that? Why do you do it? Oh, I know how to do this.
Well, so it's like playing the piano, so you'll become an expert at it, so you'll internalize it.
Yeah, and there are two things that have to happen here. One is you're building strength, like you used the example of playing the piano. You know, a concert pianist, fingers are so strong that if they hit a note, they can break the key every time. And I knew a concert pianist when I was at university, and he would practice on an upright, and he was always breaking keys. There was that much strength in his fingers just from all of that practice. So that training builds strength, or to put it another way, it builds capacity. That's one part of the internalization. And then you were saying also that so you know how to do it. It also is training so that you don't have to think about it. It just happens, okay? So if you're training in football, move a certain way, then when you're running down the field with the football, you don't have to think, oh, I need to do this move now. It just happens because of the circumstances. That's how good football players were. Same thing with piano, or same thing with anything else. The only way this comes about is by doing it again and again and again and again and again. Repetition, okay? So this is, when you look at this, this is not about getting an intellectual understanding. What he's talking about in this chapter is training in this stuff. Boring, repetitive, nose to the grindstone, however you want to look at it, that you just do this again and again and again. That's why I gave you this ritual last week, so you'd have a little experience with that. If you really want to cultivate bodhicitta, cultivate awakening mind, then you train it. And because it is through that training process, going back to the example of the analogy of evolution, that you create the conditions so that this awakening mind can actually evolve in you. Now, this is really, really, this is a way of looking at things which is really out of fashion these days, because everybody just wants to understand it and that's good enough and then move on and do something that's more interesting. But it just doesn't work that way. If you want to give expression to awakening mind, you train it in yourself, which means working it again and again. It goes in more and more deeply. Every time it goes in another layer, it starts hitting all of the material that doesn't want to have anything to do with in us. And we have lots of those layers. You have ran into a big one when we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. Just like... that's part of the training process. And you'll experience plateaus where you don't seem to be getting anywhere. But basically what's happening is when you've hit material which you don't have the capacity to penetrate. So when you're experiencing a plateau and you keep training, you're actually building up the capacity which is going to allow you to penetrate into that. And so it's not a particularly linear process. It doesn't proceed smoothly. How many of you have studied evolution at all? A little bit. Is it a smooth process? You know, if you just look at what is the Precambrian explosion, you know, there is the way evolution works. When you look at it, and it's, it doesn't matter what's evolving. You can, I've watched the videos in which now they have these really amazing algorithms for generating solutions to extremely complex problems. And what they do is they throw a couple of solutions in, but they don't work very well. And then they have the solutions mate and produce a whole bunch more solutions. And they try them all out, and the ones that work a bit better get a bit more energy, and then they get to mate. And so you can watch these things. And you'll see that something goes up like this, goes up and up, and then it reaches its limit, and it collapses, and the next one moves up, and things like that. And it's a totally nonlinear process. But through this, through these evolutionary algorithms, they get things that no human would actually ever get to because they just wouldn't have enough time. And they solve the problem. And they have the same thing in the animal and the plant world and in our brains. There's so many things that function through a process, through evolutionary processes. It's a very powerful way of looking at things. But it's not particularly linear. When things build up to a certain point, you find yourself in a new space. And in that new space, all kinds of things are possible that simply weren't possible before. So you find at a certain point, as you train in this, that something opens up. And now you can move and express awakening mind in areas you never thought were possible before. Just like, huh? And then, of course, once you do that, you find there's a whole bunch of new stuff to work through as well. What's being described here are very relatively high-level principles that are going to cover this whole process. So this is not going into the details of the process at all. That's the kind of thing that you do with your teacher, where you find yourself working with the thing, how do I work with this particular thing? Or, and as your own experience develops, you understand more and more how to work with different problems and difficulties and challenges that come up. And that, again, is the evolutionary process that I'm describing. These are very high-level principles which create the conditions in which this process can take place. Okay, but how far this process goes and how deeply it goes is basically dependent on one thing and one thing only. It's how much energy you put into it, because all evolutionary processes work on the basis of accumulation of energy. And so you've got to put energy in if there's going to be, it doesn't happen by itself. Okay, is this making sense? Okay, it's a little different way of looking at this thing rather than, it's not about following rules. It's about creating the conditions in which a process can take root and grow in you. Okay, let's take a look at this. So, I'm in Gunther's translation. There's not a huge difference for this. I'll keep the two in front of me and see. Gampopa starts off by saying there are five tasks complete the training and aspiration. I think comprise, as Kenshok Jiaotsen translates, is better than complete. And the five are not to exclude beings from our thoughts, to be mindful of the usefulness of this attitude or how it's beneficial, to accumulate the prerequisites, which is a terrible translation, gathering the two accumulations is Kenshok Jiaotsen's, which I don't think is that much better. The two accumulations are traditionally translated as merit and wisdom, or merit and pristine awareness. I prefer to translate these as generating goodness and nurturing awareness. It loses the, I can't, if anybody can figure out a word, a verb, which has both the meaning of generate and nurture, I'll be grateful for that. I suppose you could say nurture goodness and nurture awareness, so the two nurturings. I think that's closer. That's the third one. Practicing the enlightened mind repeatedly, ever again, purify this attitude, it's the same thing. And then accepting and rejecting the four positive and negative qualities. Now here I have to go on a little rant for translation. Okay. In Tibetan, as a language, Kara, is there any water here? Well, thank you. To say temperature, you juxtapose hot and cold. That's the word for temperature in Tibetan. Ta, trong, hot, cold. To say distance, thank you. To say distance, guess what you say? Near, far, okay? So this also applies to verbs, except very few translators apply it to verbs. They just translate both verbs. And so to me, when it says to accept and reject, that would be like saying, how much is the hot cold right now? No, we would say, what is the temperature? So you have to accept and reject. Well, that's exercise discipline, okay? Or so it's exercise discipline with respect to the four positive and negative qualities. It doesn't have to be, it does mean accepting the four positive, or actually it doesn't mean accepting. It means taking up. It actually is the verb to pick up. And so it's not really accepting. And it's not rejecting either. It's stopping. So these are overly literal translations as far as I'm concerned. Because, Joe?
Do you mean there's one verb, there's not a verb that refers to the four positive and a verb that refers to the four negative.
Well, you see, in Tibetan, what you can do is you can use these parallel structures, and you can go on for there's a sentence Rinpoche wrote that I had translated, which he kept this parallel structure going through about five different things, but it was all practicing this, stopping that, this, and just piled up. It was a monster sentence to translate into English, but it was absolutely beautiful in Tibetan because it was so concise. So here you would have positive and negative would be black and white. That's what the literal Tibetan is. So you would have white, black, accept, reject, etc., etc. That's how the actual sentence is constructed in Tibetan. But they're referring to both of these processes, which are just flip sides of each other the whole time. In English, it'd be more appropriate to translate just the process, which loses some of the color, but is actually much more English.
So as we talked about before, this is really it's really, how can I put this? It's frank about the dualistic nature of the way we express.
Well, it's not really dualism in the sense of subject-object. It's not talking about that at all. What it is a recognition that every process, something goes up and something goes down at the same time. So it's like two sides of a coin. That's not dualism. It's every coin just happens to have two sides.
Right. Maybe it's the wrong word. I mean, you can't have the concept positive without the concept negative.
Exactly, yeah. So it's emphasizing the interrelationship of those two very much. Yeah, okay. Exactly. So now these are the training principles. Well, the first thing if you're going to train something is to stay on the path, right? And the key, so the first one, not excluding sentient beings from our thoughts. Again, thoughts isn't really, Kensho Jiaozhen's is much closer, is not forsaking sentient beings from one's heart. If you're going to say this in English, you don't close your heart to anybody. That's what they're really saying. You don't close your heart to anyone, ever. Now, why? Because awakening mind is the intention to wake up in order to help all beings. Well, if you closed your heart to someone, you've negated that intention, right? Thing. So it's a very, very fundamental thing. Now, goes on to say, if you go down to towards the end of page 142, to call ourselves bodhisattvas while so, and I'm going to use my terminology, closing your heart to sentient beings is altogether unreasonable. It's like killing your own child and preserving his things. You're just preserving the form, but you've actually killed the essence of it. You follow? That's a pretty dramatic image. So Gampopa is a little serious about this. What this means, as I think it says elsewhere, is that if you go on to page 144, it says every hour. I can't remember where it is exactly, but if you harbor an attitude like this for a period of an hour to 2 hours, it's regarded as having taken root in you. So if you've got angry at someone, and all of us do from time to time, and you think, I'm never going to help that person again. Okay, then make sure that within an hour you go, okay, I'm not going to help him for a while. So that absolute rejection and closing down doesn't happen in you. Now, when you think of this, this is a very, very powerful thing. You don't close your heart to anyone. My father told me the story of there was a Scottish woman in a small village in Scotland who had the reputation that she had never said anything bad about anybody ever in her life. And some wag came up to her, and what would you be thinking of the devil, ma'am? Oh, he'd be busy, I warrant. Not closing her heart to anything. You know. And it's a very powerful thing. If we look at it more internally, as I've suggested as a way of working with this this idea of bodhicitta, is that if we look at it in terms of the world of our experience, not closing our heart to any being translates as not closing our heart to anything that is in us internally? Now, how many of you have closed off some part of yourself you just don't want to have anything to deal with? Okay, it's the same thing. One is just internally focused, the other is externally focused. But we're both talking about the same thing. So number one part of the training is you don't close your heart, you don't shut down or close your heart to anything. That's really tough. But that's where the training starts. Okay? This is really no joke stuff. So we find on the top of page 143, when harm has been done in return for a good deed, even then it has to be answered with great compassion. The best men in the human world return a good deed for an evil one. How many of you are familiar with the prisoner's dilemma? Okay, it's a game. It's a very highly studied game. And there's a professor I know at UCLA who did a thesis on the prisoner's dilemma with imperfect information, which just gets really interesting. I won't go into the details of it, and anybody who's listening to this can look it up on the web because there's oodles of stuff on it. But it's a game, or it's a situation where if you cooperate, if you don't cooperate with a person, and the other person cooperates with you, you get the best payoff. If you both cooperate, you both get a good payoff, and then if neither of you cooperate, then you both get a very bad payoff. So it's not a zero-sum game at all. And it's an iterative thing, is that you do round after round after round with the same person. Well, apparently, when there's imperfect information, you're not sure what the other person is doing. One of the best things is to randomly cooperate so that you're actually always injecting something in there which builds a basis for trust. And this is applied very extensively in negotiation theories, and how do you create the conditions where you can develop the trust that is necessary for resolving difficult conflicts. So there is a very practical application of returning harm with good. And there's the very, very famous line from the Dhammapada, which is, anger is never conquered by anger, or hate is never conquered by hate. Hate is only conquered by love. And it's very, very true. You know, people will fight and fight and fight, and nothing actually happens. You get into a win-lose, maybe. But nothing really changes in the relationship until one or both of them said, I'm tired of fighting. Can we work something out? So very, very important. Number two is to be mindful of the benefits of this attitude, or why it's good, why it is a good thing. And the purpose of this is to protect or safeguard this environment in which this process of evolution is taking place. So he refers to the Gandharva Sutra, which is a small sutra inserted into the Avatamsaka Sutra. I didn't have time to look it up. I imagine all of this is in Tom Cleary's translation of the Avatamsaka Sutra. The 230 similes of for awakening mind and why it is a good thing. Basically, for this, when you think of awakening mind, what happens in you? When you remember it, when you recall it, what happens in you? Anybody?
Nicer to people.
Okay, that's how it manifests in your behavior. What happens in you when you think of it?
It's very much an opening.
Mm-hmm.
It's relaxing. It's a letting go of a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
capital S.
Yeah. It cuts through a lot of stuff. What does it do with your reactive emotions? Like anger, jealousy, pride, greed, you know, the usual suspects.
I can look at them rather than get caught up in them.
Yeah. So it cuts through reactive emotions, it improves behavior, etc. You don't have to memorize a long list here. You can if you wish. All you have to do is recall what the actual effect is when you connect with awakening mind. You feel it immediately. It never has a bad effect. Okay? That's what I want to drive at here, or get across here. Okay, point three. So by being mindful of all such virtues, I mean, this is the typical way of training. What I would say is, in terms of the way we might train in this culture, is not memorize this list and constantly be reminding ourselves of it. That's sort of like, that's a little bit of a childish way. It is just to recall it and feel it. And recall it and feel it again. And that does two things. It not only reminds you of why it is a good thing, you're also connecting with it again and again every time you recall it. That's part of the training. The method for obtaining a strong enlightened attitude. So, again, this is Gunther's rather contorted English. This next one is about building capacity. Yeah, that's the way that I would interpret for strengthening awakening mind. It's building capacity. And how you build capacity is you nurture goodness in your life and you nurture awareness. That's how you build capacity. And then there's a whole list of things that you can do there. There's the 10 fundamental rules, which Gunther has a footnote on. And then the 4 expedients by which sentient beings feel themselves attracted by us. Oh, give me a break, Gunther. I mean, he's a great person. I had the joy of meeting him, and I invited him to give a program in Vancouver. And he was just a great guy, very, very, very generous, and super knowledgeable, and really very, very sincere. But his English is terrible. Retranslate the 4 expedients by which sentient beings feel themselves attracted by us. We will translate that simply as 4 ways to gather people around you. And the 4 ways are, and this is one of the things I want to show you, that this is much wider range of application than in just the spiritual domain. The 4 ways are, be generous, specifically provide people with the necessities. Okay. Speak gently. Be courteous. I think that's... Yes, be courteous. And engage people in meaningful activity. So provide people with the necessities. Speak gently. Treat people courteously or politely and engage them in meaningful activity. Now, that is how a bodhisattva attracts people so that he or she has somebody to teach. Let's shift context for a moment. These are very, very effective management principles. You have people working for you. You provide them with what they actually need to do their work. You speak to them gently. You're courteous to them. You're polite to them. And you engage them in meaningful activity. Who wouldn't want to work for you? Things that are interesting. Very, very simple. And this is what I mean about some of the principles of Buddhist thinking have very, very wide range of application. And that's just one application. You can make up other ones. But it's a very, very good way to live your life, you know, where you can provide people with what they actually need. People always appreciate that. When I was driving here, I was listening to a report of this bank in New Orleans, which all of their records were wiped out because they were right in 9th Precinct and or 9th Ward or whatever, as well as almost, you know, all of the documents for the customers, you know. So what did this bank president do? All of the customers of the bank could have $500 a day max withdraw from ATM. And he had no idea whether they actually had the money in their accounts or not. But that's what he allowed them to do. He lost about $1 million on that. But the bank prospered, and the customers prospered tremendously because he just provided them with what they actually needed in the wake of Katrina. It's phenomenal. It's one of three black-owned banks. It was the first black-owned bank in New Orleans. And this was the attitude of the president. And just really making the bank serve the needs of the community. It was great. But it was just a wonderful example of providing people with what they need. Tremendously loyal customers. And his grandfather had said to him, 97% of the people in the world are honest. 3% aren't. Work your business so that it serves the 97%. Good principle. Then we get down to the spiritual awareness. Now, again, you want to nurture awareness in your life? Very simply. Drop the stories and act. That's all you have to do. And when they're talking about all of these fancy words, what they really mean is just drop the stories, drop all of the stories, all the stories about who you are, all of the stories about who the other person is, all the stories about what is right and what is wrong. You drop all of the stories, you just wake up right in that moment and you do what comes to you. That's how you nurture awareness.
And that's number four?
Pardon?
That's number four?
No, that's number four. That's the next one. That's how you. The other one was how you nurture goodness. This is how you nurture awareness. All of this is part of three. Yeah, that's right. And you notice, and it comes down at the end. There's also the fostering of attention. A bodhisattva must always think, today I will accumulate merits and spiritual awareness and bring merits to all beings. I will retranslate that this way. A person who is in the process of waking up must always form the intention, today I will nurture goodness and awareness and bring goodness to all beings. That reads a little better in my mind. That may be just my bias. Okay, number four. This is constantly remind yourself of this attitude. And that is to spread and deepen this attitude or this intention in you. And the way you do that is you just keep calling it to mind. Skip down a couple of paragraphs. It says, purification of mind is motive, substance, and correct conduct. Well, the motive, which is again the genesis of awakening mind, that's one of Gunther's translations for that term, is intending to help beings. So you're naturally going to cultivate loving kindness and compassion. And again, this goes straight to the one that we were talking about earlier, is not closing your heart down. Now, you aren't necessarily going to be able to engender loving kindness and compassion for all sentient beings. That's actually quite a tall order. But you can foster the intention to do so. And you can foster the aspiration to do so. And in doing that, you're creating fertile ground for for awakening mind to grow or evolve in you. And the second one is to do it now. The prayer there, until I have attained enlightenment, I take refuge. This is Gunther's translation of the prayer that we do at the beginning of a practice period. Until I awaken, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and can't remember. The Supreme Assembly, which is Atisha's word for or a phrase for the Sangha, through generosity and other virtues. Can you read it there? Use the microphone. I should know it by heart, but I know it's in Tibetan.
Until I awaken, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. Through the goodness of generosity and other virtues, may I awaken fully in order to help all beings.
Exactly. Thank you, Carol. Now, this was written by Atisha in the 11th century. Memorize it. It's one of the formulas for refuge and awakening mind that is used in all the traditions of bodhicitta, in all the all traditions of the Tibetan tradition. And it's just something to have to say. If you listen carefully to the Ewoks in Return of the Jedi, you'll find that the language that the Ewoks are speaking is Tibetan.
Really?
Yes. It's recorded and then played back at very high speed and distorted. But every now and then you get, and someone pointed this out to me, and so I went to the movie and I went, listen to it. Right, because and there is one phrase in it, which is Sungji Chud and Sochi Chok, which is exactly the Tibetan for this verse. And I went, oh, it's right there. there's also Amani Pe Mihung in there.
So appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, they snuck the stuff in. You know, the Christian fundamentalists are right. We're taking over the world. Subliminal projection. Okay. Then the third way that we spread and deepen it is acting correctly through awakening. We seek to act appropriately in situations. This benefits ourselves and it benefits others. The main way it benefits ourselves is that when you act appropriately, how much do you have to think about? Yeah, it clears the mind. That's the primary reason for acting appropriately. It leaves you at peace. And a very, very good way to approach difficult decisions is, morally difficult situations or ones which you want something but don't do what's right, is what will leave me at peace here? That's actually a pretty good criteria for making important decisions. What will leave me at peace? Or what will allow me to be at peace? I mean, when you look at the savings and loans thing that we had in the 80s, now all of the stuff we have going on now, the predatory loans, and some of those things you hear are absolutely horrific, where people show up and say, we'll help you pay, we'll help you not move out of your house, just sign over a house to us, and then they actually kick them out of the house. This is just basically various forms of theft. I don't know how these people sleep at night, but apparently they do. Then number five, is not to forget. And it's actually putting it into action, so it really comes part of your life. And that is training in these four, what are called the four, avoiding the four black dharmas and practicing the four white ones. Now, for some reason, I have a real block against these because I've tried to memorize these. I wouldn't tell you how many times over the last 30 years, and I just can never remember them. It's a strange list, but it's actually a very powerful one. First one is, don't deceive your spiritual teachers. Gunter says cheating, but it's more about deceiving. Why is this so important? Well, I'm going to give a experience only interpretation. And we discussed this when we were discussing the teacher back in chapter 2 or 3 or whatever it was. The teacher is how awakening mind is appearing in your experience. It's how your mind is trying to tell you how to wake up. Okay? So if you deceive your spiritual teacher, you're actually closing the door on your own spiritual development. So it's completely pointless to lie or do anything surreptitiously or anything to your spiritual teacher, because all you're doing is closing something in yourself. And that's why it's regarded as a really bad thing to do. It's not because you're going to affect the teacher. It has a horrible, a really, really deeply horrible effect in you. The second one causing remorse in others when remorse is not appropriate. I'm in Kendra Johnson's translation on page 176 right now. Somebody does something good. Maybe it was stupid. Maybe it was foolish. But they did it. They did something good. They did something good because they wanted to do something good. Don't make them regret it, even if they're going to regret it. Maybe they gave all their money away and they're going to starve to death or something like that. But that goodness that they've done acts as a seed in them. If you then cause them to regret it, what you've done is to cause them to disown their connection with something that is a positive growth process in them. You know how we do this in our culture? Very, very consistently. Shame. Pardon?
Say like that, you hear it all the time with people with their parents or with their spouse, like just constant.
Yeah. No. We don't necessarily tell them it's a bad thing, but we cause them to feel shame, and because they feel shame, they regret having done it. So it can happen very, very easily. So when somebody does something good, does something virtuous, does something which actually is uplifting and opening, really be alert as to how you interact with that so that you don't even inadvertently cause them to feel remorse. That's one of the reasons why you're encouraged to take joy in the good works of others, because then you celebrate it. Yes, Randy.
What would be a good cause to make someone feel ashamed? In both translations, it says without cause.
Yes. Well, it says... Well, it says causing remorse in others when remorse is not appropriate. That's something about without cause.
Gunther says to make others feel ashamed without cause.
Yeah, and that's more when it's not appropriate to do so. So I think that's Gunther's. It's a misleading translation there. Shame is a very is powerful, and it is also useful. It's what actually allows society to function. You don't want to do certain things. You will act in conformity with the rules of society, and when you don't, then you feel shame about that. But that's very different from from that point of view, a sense of shame is a self-correcting mechanism in us. Well, yes, it comes out as regret, but we regret because there's a shame component. Shame is regarded in Buddhism, not the toxic shame where it's an identity and things like that, but generally regarded as a virtuous an emotion which moves you in a virtuous direction. But what I'm talking about is when somebody does something which is unusual, good, and people think, oh, well, that was a stupid thing to do, and then they will feel shame about that, and they will regret their virtue. That participating in that process or in that would be a violation of this precept. Yeah.
Shaming is also a very good way, not good, positive, good, effective, to control other people.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of that. Yes. Kara?
I was actually flying, over the weekend, and mm-hmm. on one of the flights that I took, we were about to land, and the flight attendant got on the intercom, and I guess we were on the honor system for seat backs and tray tables, and she actually said over the intercom, if someone around you isn't doing it and you ask them to or something like that, you can call us and we'll come over and humiliate them into compliance. And I wanted to put, it was, and I wanted to put my tray table down and my seat back and ding the button for myself and dare this woman to try to humiliate me. I'm not a troublemaker.
So we noticed. Okay.
But I think that the audacity of that is terrible, that our society is moving in that direction where it's just so out in the open. I'm sorry. That was my funny story.
Okay. Please, Joe.
Would an example of shaming be when somebody says, oh, somebody asked me for some money and I gave it to them, and you say, oh, you twit, they're taking you for a ride, that kind of thing?
Absolutely.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah. That's a perfect example.
Sorry, but on a more like reality-based level, I think that shame as a means of control is something like in really fiercely codependent relationships, that shame is always a big...
the whole codependent thing is based on shame. And
absolutely.
Addiction is, there's some theories of addiction is that it's based on shame.
Totally.
So, yeah. Okay, number three. This one is denigrating a bodhisattva. Now, what this means is that someone who's given rise to this attitude, who's formed this intention, by denigrating them, you're denigrating the whole notion of what you yourself are trying to cultivate. So, again, this is undermining oneself. You notice that all of these are problematic, not just because they have, not primarily for the effect that they have on others, but primarily for the effect that they have on you. This is very, very important in Buddhist morality. Because working with notion of the idea of karma as an evolutionary process. You're setting in motion process of evolution in you. You really got to look at what are the effects of acting in this way. What am I setting in motion in me? And one can say, oh, this is a very self-serving way, but it's also a very accurate way. And you're really paying attention to the only world that you actually can know, which is the world of your own experience. Sometimes, I mean, by some fluke, something that we do, you know, inappropriately for somebody else, it may have a very good effect, but it still has a very, on them, but it has still has a very bad effect on us because it's a reactive process that we're nurturing a reactive process in ourselves, not an awakening process. And then the last one is behaving deceitfully towards sentient beings. We deceive others usually, I think probably always, but I'll say usually just to be safe, because we don't want to deal with what's actually going on. We're trying to take a shortcut. And so it's a shutting down of awareness right there. We know what's really going on, we just don't want to relate to it, so there's an ignoring. And one of my friends, his definition of evil is deliberate ignoring. And it's a very effective definition. Whenever you deliberately ignore something, you're engaging evil. So, this is the... Now, the opposites of these, of course, are the white dharmas. Saying what is true, particularly with our spiritual teachers. Encouraging and establishing people in virtuous activity. Praising or extolling the good qualities of people who have developed formed this attitude, and that in a certain sense that's another version of rejoicing, you know, celebrating, and taking as one's basic approach to life the intention to be helpful to others. Now, the last thing I want to touch on this evening is if you look at these five things, if you go back to the paragraph at the beginning of the chapter on Kensho Jeltsin's, page 173, I said this is a method of training. Look at the training principles that are described. This is the paragraph that begins. The first one is the method for not losing bodhicitta. The second one is the method by which bodhicitta does not weaken. So let's just drop bodhicitta. One is, what are the principles in training? One, how do you stay on the training and don't fall off it? Second, how do you not undermine the training? Third is, how do you strengthen the training? Fourth is, how do you deepen the training? Fifth is, how do you have it stay with you all the time? Now, those are very good training principles, and it doesn't matter whether you're training bodhicitta or, you know, training basketball. If you really want to develop a capacity in you, those five principles will be very good, and you can apply them to any discipline. This is what I mean about really taking in Buddhist thinking, because the way that a lot of this stuff has been formulated and thought through over the years, embodies ways of approaching aspects of our life, even if they aren't explicitly spiritual, but ways which have sound and proven reliability of being effective. You know, so maybe I'm making a mountain of a molehill, but I've just found those kinds of things very effective. Okay. So that concludes that chapter. We did a whole chapter rather than spending like... It is the shortest chapter in the book, yes. Your meditation practice. I'm going to stick you with the four black dharmas. Okay? What I want you to do is, this is an exercise that we've done but with respect to other things, but I want you to go through the four, this is page 177 in Kinchok Jyotsen's, these four, explanation of the first unwholesome deed, deceiving spiritual master, abbot, or one worthy of offerings. So, deceiving a spiritual teacher. Okay, I want you to imagine doing that. What happens in you? What happens in your body? What are the emotions? What process does it initiate in you? That's what I want you to reflect on. What happens when imagine deceiving your spiritual teacher, telling them about some great experience which you didn't actually have? That's what a lot of people do. Or try to get away with it sometimes. Seriously. And or being dishonest with them in some other way. Okay? And just feel what happens in you there. In your body, what emotions come up, what process does it start happening in you? Okay, like being hooked up to a lie detector. Second one, what happens in you when you cause someone to regret something good that they did? How do you feel? Now, in some of the situations you've been describing, righteous will be something you feel. I want you to explore the feeling of righteousness. It's quite interesting, but I won't say anything more about it. We'll take that up next time. Third one. When you criticize or denigrate someone who's making an effort to wake up or making an effort to awake, to cultivate awakening mind. What effect does that have in you? Molly?
We're talking specifically about people who are making efforts to wake up through this practice, not through other practices.
No, through any practice.
Through any practice.
Yeah, they're intending to wake up, and you criticize or denigrate them. What effect does that have in you? What does it set in motion?
Okay.
Because when I maybe I'm too eclectic here, but you know, whether it's Zen or Theravadin or Christianity or Islam, I mean, I've had very good fortune, even though I haven't really sought it, but I've run into contemplatives in various traditions. And they may have a very different framework, but the real contemplatives in any tradition are struggling in their own way with exactly the same things that we are, which is how actually to be present. I was listening to a panel on religion in the modern world a couple of weeks ago, and one of the panelists had been responsible for convening a group of people from different faiths to decide on certain ethical principles. I think it was in medicine, I can't remember. And he found that as long as they were discussing ethical principles, it was just a mess. Because people from the Jewish people would be arguing this, and the Christians would be arguing this, and the Islams would be arguing this, and the Buddhists would be arguing that, and the Hindus would be arguing, and it just went nowhere. So they just scratched all of that. And they said, in this situation, and they would give a scenario, what would you do? What would you advise? What outcome would you look for? And they found that these people actually agreed very much on what the outcome should be. But they all had a very, very different way of getting to it in terms of their faith and their belief and their ethical codes and things like that. So some would say, well, because of X, Y, and Z, this is what we do. And another person would say, well, we do the same thing, but it would be because of A, B, and C. And this is what I'm pointing at here. It isn't... look at the substance of what's going on, not at the form. Joe.
Whenever I get a little bit closed off and sectarian, I came up with a question to ask myself that releases that. And the question is, need a Buddha know anything about Buddhism?
Yeah, you remind me, there's a Buddhist teacher that I know here in L.A., and she and I went for a walk. She was describing how she was trying to decide which of two guys to date. And one was a Dharma practitioner, but she didn't get along with him so well. And the other was not a Dharma practitioner. And I said, well, that's a no-brainer. But she got along with him quite well. I said, well, shouldn't I be dating a Buddhist? I said, only if you feel Buddhism is a monopoly on truth. She went, huh? Okay, fourth one. What happens in you when you cheat or deceive anybody? And you can put an exploit in there. Take advantage of. The reason this is regarded as one of the ways of separating yourself from awakening mind is that whenever we exploit, take advantage, deceive, etc., we are negating our intention to help others. Regardless of the effect on them, we're negating our intention. So, that's what I want you to work with, is what actually happens in you when you do any of these. Now, do bear in mind, this is the last point for this evening, I said earlier that one way to approach Buddhist morality is, or we approach morality in Buddhism is, we do these things, we take up these ethical codes, because when we act this way, there is less turbulence, less disturbance in our mind. And because there's less disturbance in our mind, then our mind is quieter. Because it is quieter, it's clearer. Because it is clearer, we see things more clearly and we can act appropriately. So it's actually a virtuous cycle. The other thing, aspect is, these are descriptions of awakened behavior. And in general, Buddhist morality is far more descriptive than prescriptive. It's why I don't like the word precept to translate these things, because it's something you're meant to do. It should be a descript instead of a precept. When you a person who is awake doesn't cheat other people, period. That's just how it is. So acting this way is a way of fostering that process, or fostering that way of approaching the world in us. So it's another benefit from it. Okay, is this clear to everybody? Okay, so this is how we nurture our intention to wake up in order to help others. Now, starting in chapter 11, we talk about how, which is, no, actually, is this? Yeah, chapter 11, that's a really short chapter. We'll go straight into generosity from there. What we now get into are what are the six perfections. This is, how do we actually do it? I mean, and this is, how do we live our life, and how do we, as an expression of this awakening mind, and go through the six perfections of generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditative stability, and pristine awareness. So that's what we'll be doing over the next... we'll probably spend about a week on each one. I don't think we'll need to spend much more. And we're actually going to wrap this whole thing up in... certainly... The bodhicitta chapter was a very major one. There's some very thorny material, technical material, in the five paths and the 10 stages, and then Buddhahood. So, probably two and a half months. So, we should be in very good shape. Just so that everybody knows this, starting in May 6th, we'll be meeting at the Center for Life, which is on Washington. I'll put up the address on the website. And most of you know it. You don't know it, Elena. Speak to somebody here. They'll tell you. Do you know where it is? Okay. You know? Okay. Joe, Chuck, Julia, Molly, you can help them. You know where it is, don't you, Alex? Yeah, it's further west.
You have just heard a talk by Ken MacLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken MacLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken MacLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge, and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes, and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast, or any portion thereof, with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.